This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Ras Baraka prepares to undo the corporate legacy of Cory Booker in Newark, New Jersey. The big banks invest in their version of a new Detroit, and it's Temple University versus the Black community in Philadelphia.
But first, the U.S. and Europe appear to be the main beneficiaries of the crisis in northern Nigeria. At the insistence of the French and Americans, Nigeria and four of its neighbors, Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Benin, are putting together a regional response to Boko Haram, the group that kidnapped hundreds of girls almost 6 weeks ago. The West is providing the training, equipment, and money. In other words, the U.S. and Europe are arranging the military defense and strategy for West Africa. We spoke with Abiyomi Azikwe, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, and asked him, what's wrong with this picture?
I wrote an article just this last past week saying that why should a conference concerned about internal security of Nigeria and West Africa be held in Paris? And I think the question speaks volumes to the degree of neocolonialism that is still prevalent on the African continent today. France has deployed numerous troops to Africa in various countries. They're now in the Central African Republic. They're in Mali. They were involved in the bombing operation over Libya. And, of course, they're also involved in Niger, where they own the largest uranium mines inside of that country, Ariba. So this is just an effort on the part of France, along with the United States and other imperialist states, to further and deepen their military intervention on the African continent. And I think also it represents the value of Africa in terms of its resources, as well as the strategic geographical location in regard to the world economic system.
Yes, France has militarily never left Africa. Its troops, its foreign legion, are still there. But the United States is now the biggest Western military presence in Africa.
Yes, and I think, of course, that makes a lot of sense. Since World War II, the United States emerged clearly as the leading imperialist power in the world. They have maintained that position over the last 70-plus years. And I think that it's going to, in fact, intensify based upon the fact that the economic crisis that had hit the world capitalist system during 2007 and 2008 has not abated, and that it's going to, of course, continue. And as a result of that, the U.S. needs outlets for oil, for natural gas, and for other strategic minerals in order to shore up its own waning economic strength throughout the world. They also want to compete with the efforts of the People's Republic of China, which now is the largest trading partner with the African continent. And, of course, we see that taking place both on the continent as well as in other areas. For example, Eric Holder just announced indictments against five Chinese military officials under the guise of cyber warfare against corporations here in the United States. It's almost laughable when you consider the fact that the National Security Agency and other intelligence services have programs that attempt to spy on everyone throughout the entire globe. So I think China is far behind the United States in any of its espionage efforts directed toward its adversaries as well as towards its friends.
In Africa, it's as if the United States and its allies are saying to China, okay, you can have all the trade you want, but we've got political control and we can shut it off if we like because of our military presence.
Yes, it'll be very difficult for Africa to develop any type of independent foreign policy as it relates to politics or economics, for the simple fact that you have the United States so heavily involved with almost the majority of African governments at this point. And what's interesting about Nigeria is that leading up to this latest crisis involving the kidnapping of the high school students from Chibok in Borno State in the northeast, which is already under a state of emergency that was declared by President Goodluck Jonathan. What's the problem is that they were already involved in joint naval maneuvers earlier this year in the Gulf of Guinea. They're already doing consultations with the Nigerian security forces and intelligence forces that goes back several years now. So this is really nothing new. And the deployment of 80 U.S. military personnel this week in Chad, which ostensibly is also geared towards the rescue of the 270-plus high school female students in northeastern Nigeria. So this is really just being utilized, the abduction of girls and the escalation of attacks by the Boko Haram sect is being utilized as a rationale for further U.S. military intervention in Africa. And the question is, who's really behind Boko Haram? Many Nigerians have speculated for a number of years that there are high-ranking political as well as military officials who are tacitly supplying support to Boko Haram in an effort to weaken the government of President Goodluck Jonathan, who they want to remove from office at least by 2015, and he may be removed even before then.
Yes, that this may be partly a manifestation of internal squabbles within the ruling circles in Nigeria. But there is no question that Boko Haram has been greatly strengthened by the huge flow of arms throughout North Africa resulting from the NATO attack and regime change in Libya.
Yeah, this is much of the thought and speculation surrounding this. However, the Nigerian military has substantial arms caches. They have a large defense force inside the country, and this is why many people, even within Nigeria itself, don't understand why they cannot take charge of this counterinsurgency operation against Boko Haram. Obviously, as many people feel, there are elements within the military itself who want to see these attacks take place because it weakens the stature of President Jonathan, and it also raises questions about his ability and capacity to wage such a counterinsurgency program against Boko Haram. So this is, of course, reflective of both the internal politics of Nigeria as well as the broader international politics involving inter-imperialist rivalry, as well as the desire on the part of the United States and France to dominate resources, waterways, and the overall economic direction of the African continent. So it goes back to what Dr. Kwame Nkrumah talked about during the 1960s, that Africa needs its own all-Africa high command, a military force that can deal with internal conflicts and can also deal with external threats to the African continent. And Colonel Gaddafi also talked about similar force that was needed for the African continent when the AU was formed in 2002 and the CERT conference, which was held in 1999 in Libya, to try to map out the refurbishing and restructuring of the Organization of African Unity. Now, with the OAU anniversary coming up this weekend, hopefully there will be some thinking and reflection within the African Union around these issues, because it doesn't make the AU look good at all that here all of these security discussions and all of these issues involving the internal security of the largest, most populous state on the African continent, that is Nigeria, the Federal Republic of Nigeria, is taking place above their heads and behind their backs. So what does this say about the AU, and what does it say about the capacity of Africa to deal with its own internal affairs? So this is a serious crisis for the continent, and until the African continent gains control of its own internal security, there could not be any genuine independence or real economic growth. And they're claiming that Nigeria now has the largest economy on the African continent. This is what's being said by the financial publications, but at the same time, they're incapable of dealing with their own internal security. So therefore, there's a certain logic to increased imperialist intervention in Nigeria as well as other parts of the continent.
Yes, we are seeing greater military integration in Africa, in the East, and now in the West. But it's under the actual command, and certainly financed by, the West.
Yes, it most definitely is. We look at the military base of AFRICOM in Djibouti at Camp Le Bonheur, where there are thousands of U.S. as well as French troops based there. They announced recently we're going to reinvest another $750 million in upgrading Camp Le Bonheur in Djibouti. And, of course, the large-scale proxy forces in Somalia, 22,000 African Union mission to Somalia troops, Amazon, that are financed by the U.S. and by the European Union that are based there to ostensibly fight al-Shabaab. And Kenya, of course, has been for a long time a hub for the United States Navy in East Africa. So all of these developments are taking place, and we don't believe that they are being done out of the generosity or even the security concerns of U.S. imperialism, but only based upon its economic and political interests.
And this recent transfer of 100 U.S. troops to Chad, people seem not to understand that that means the establishment of a U.S. drone base in Chad, in addition to the one in Niger and in Burkina Faso.
Yes, they're popping up all over the continent. They're in Somalia, they're in Ethiopia, they're in the Seychelles, way out in the Indian Ocean. And now, of course, as you mentioned, in Niger, it was established last year after the French invasion of Mali in the north, where they still remain and where fighting is still going on, even though it's not making the front page of the corporate newspapers. But all of these military interventions are doing nothing to stabilize the situation inside of Africa. In fact, it's worsening the security inside these African countries and also undermining the capacity of these states to deal with their own internal security. In Mali, they had problems with the Tuareg population going all the way back to the early 1960s, and they were always dealt with internally or within a regional framework. And now, since we've had such deep intervention by AFRICOM, it appears as if Mali and other states are incapable of dealing with their own internal affairs and even on a regional level. So this raises really serious questions about the nature of AFRICOM and why it exists and why, when they get involved in a situation, the conditions worsen rather than improve.
The lesson appears to be that the United States and AFRICOM have an interest in instability because it promotes increased U.S. penetration militarily of Africa.
Yeah, this is our view. And, of course, we believe very strongly that Africa has to deal with its own internal security, and that if it does not, there's going to be even more U.S. troops operating on the African continent. There are going to be more drones. There are going to be more military bases. And, of course, Africa will be completely recolonized by the West. And, of course, this is their desire. This is their aim. And this is the real struggle of the African people for the 21st century.
That was Abiyomi Azikiwe of the Pan-African Newswire.
Ras Baraka, son of the late radical poet Amiri Baraka and a high school principal, will be the next mayor of Newark, New Jersey. One quarter of Newark schools are charters, largely thanks to former mayor and current U.S. Senator Cory Booker. Ras Baraka opposed growing charterization and school closings. We spoke with Larry Hamm, chairman of the Newark-based People's Organization for Progress.
Let me say that I am overjoyed with the election of Mayor-elect Ras Baraka. I think it's going to be a significant break with the past, with the Booker administration. It certainly was one of those rare situations where the candidate that the grassroots people were supporting prevailed, and he prevailed over his opponent that outspent him maybe as much as 10-1. Ras Baraka comes out of the progressive tradition, and of course he is the son of the radical poet and activist Amiri Baraka. I'm certain that it's not going to be business as usual. However, Ras Baraka faces a daunting challenge with the conditions here in Newark, an official unemployment rate of 15%, which is double the national average. In the black communities, we have unemployment among black men in the South, Central, and West wards as high as 50%. He will come into office on July 1st, that's when his term begins, facing a $93 million budget deficit. And that's going to be a hard nut to crack. It's difficult for me to see how right now he's going to close that gap without either some layoffs or property tax increases, or he's going to have to ask Governor Christie in the state for more state aid. And not the least of which among these situations is the situation with the public school. Now, he came into office as an opponent of the state-appointed superintendent of schools, Cammy Anderson, whose latest act that has outraged the black community has been this One Newark plan. This is her plan for the reorganization of Newark schools that will result in some school closures and the bolstering and maybe even the opening up of more charter schools and charter schools that will be either located or co-located where there are existing public schools. I would say almost the entire education activist community in Newark is opposed to this plan. And when he was a candidate, Mayor-elect Baraka voiced his opposition to the plan also. The community is still calling for her resignation. As a matter of fact, there's a broad coalition of education activists that oppose the One Newark plan. Among that coalition, of course, is the People's Organization for Progress, along with many other organizations, including a group called the Newark Student Union. This group of students has been very vocal, and right now I would pretty much say represents the vocal leadership of the high school students in Newark. They've been attending almost every board meeting, making their voices heard and their opinions known on the various issues affecting the Newark school. But more importantly, they staged a 24-hour sit-in at the central headquarters of the Newark Board of Education. They were inside. They refused to move. And while they were inside, a number of patient and community activists were outside to make sure that the students were not brutalized or mishandled in any way.
Those community activists, including members of People's Organization for Progress.
Exactly, including members of People's Organization for Progress, the New Caucus, which is a independent caucus within the Newark Teachers Union, and many others.
In terms of the schools, there's a lot of history to roll back, not only Cory Booker's term in office as a rabid privatizer, but the state has been in control of Newark and most of the other mostly black cities in New Jersey's schools for decades now.
That's right, and one of the top three demands of the coalition opposing the One Newark plan, of course, is the resignation of Cammy Anderson, but also the return to local control of the Newark school district. When the state takeover legislation was originally written, the state takeover was only supposed to be for 5 years. The state has been in Newark now for 18 years and counting.
Mayor Baraka, when he takes over, won't be able to count on getting $100 million for the public schools from the likes of Zuckerberg's, but that may be a good thing.
I think you're certainly right. I would be surprised if Zuckerberg was to support the Baraka administration the same way he supported the Booker administration. But, you know, there are other people out there. I understand Ross Baraka is not only a politician, he's a cultural worker in his own right. He's a poet. He's published. He's been on albums with Lauryn Hill. So if he don't get money from Zuckerberg, who knows? Maybe Jay-Z or Kanye West or, you know, P. Diddy. Maybe they'll step in and put some money into the Newark School District. I know this much. The mayor-elect is going to need a lot of help. Just 2 weeks before the election, there was an article in the Star Ledger talking about the possibility of the state coming in to take over Newark's finances as it took over the city of Camden's finances. Camden is the poorest city in New Jersey. And some years ago, it was a step-by-step process, but some years ago, the state went in and took over Camden's finances. And I think the state is still in there. So this points out the challenges of black power in the 21st century. I'm old enough to remember the election of Ken Gibson. Certainly, Newark was a physically devastated city after the rebellion of 1967. There was significant property damage as a result of the rebellion, but the city recovered from that. And at the time that Gibson was elected, although the city was in recovery mode, Gibson still had some patronage reserves to deal with. There was still a lot of poverty money coming into the city. United Community Corporation was the anti-poverty agency. It was getting money from the federal government. The city of Newark was getting anti-poverty money through the Model Cities program, the Newark Board of Education was getting anti-poverty funds through a Title I program. So when Gibson first came in, he certainly didn't have as much to dole out as Amnesio, but he certainly had enough to dole out to buttress his administration and to hold in place the support he got from black folk in 1970. Ross Baraka doesn't have the resources that Ken Gibson had to work with when he came in 1970. In fact, I don't even think the city of Newark had a major budget deficit in 1970. So all the poverty money is gone. The state and the federal government has cut back their aid to the city. The municipal labor force has been whittled down by the Booker administration to the point where he was laying off hundreds of police. He actually laid off 200 cops. Now, police are the last to get laid off. When police get laid off, you know everybody else that could have been laid off has been laid off. So young Ross Baraka comes in with much less resources to deal with. So he's going to need a lot of help. It's going to be interesting to see how this turns out. I plan to help him as much as I can.
Yes, a progressive black administration in a majority black city in an age of austerity.
In the era of austerity, that is exactly right. And a black city, black administration, but with a white Republican governor who will not raise taxes, certainly will not raise taxes on the rich, and has cut back programs that help the poor and the needy in the state, many of which are part of Mayor Baraka's constituency.
Larry Hamm of People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey.
Wall Street banks and their subprime lending policies laid the groundwork for the financial collapse of Detroit, where voters have been effectively disenfranchised as the city undergo a bankruptcy process. Now, two of those banks, J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs, are offering millions of dollars toward a makeover of Detroit after it emerges from bankruptcy. Tom Stevens is an activist in resisting the corporation takeover of Detroit. He says the banks have their own agenda.
They say it's philanthropic, and then they also say they expect to make money on it. From my perspective, you know, investment is welcome. The problem is that the investment is coming with a pretty overt racist and neoliberal and neocolonial kind of framework and strings attached and, you know, restructuring imperative that is not going to benefit the vast majority of the people of the city of Detroit. Indeed, it is already doing great harm to us.
Yes, in fact, it's going to finance a restructuring that would privatize much of Detroit.
Right. The $100 million that Jamie Dimon talked about and the other large sums of money from similar types of impunity actors, you know, people who should be facing charges for predatory, fraudulent financial manipulations and are instead being praised to the skies by all the usual suspects. You know, they're giving money to all the usual suspects, you know, the nonprofits, the restructurers, the contractors, the folks that are privatizing the city and moving forward into a new kind of city, a whiter city, a richer city, and trying to pretend that there is absolutely no justice or equity issue involved in doing that in a community where 90% of the people are Latino American, African American, working class folks who are getting no benefit from this activity.
So in a sense, they're not giving money to Detroit as we know it, but to people who will create a different kind of Detroit, one that is more friendly to the interests of J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs.
There is certainly every indication of that, unless, as has happened so many times in history before, the folks who live here, the folks who are most affected by this kind of a program, rise up the way we are trying to do. And we are going to do everything we can to do it to make it more expensive for them to execute their nefarious schemes than to concede that, well, yes, we really have a community here and we really have some people here who we have to acknowledge their interests and even their rights.
And of course, you and your colleagues have indicted J.P. Morgan and Bank of America and Goldman Sachs and the rest of that pack as being the actual assassins of Detroit.
Well, not only me and my colleagues, but I think they don't even really bother to deny it, do they? I mean, it's just changed the subject. The most recent study by the Haas Institute out of Berkeley, you know, points out that Detroit and the other communities like Detroit, it were so devastated by the predatory lending and the subprime scams and all this business. Nothing that's been done to attempt to address those problems has had any effect, really. The so-called recovery just never arrived in Detroit. It was dead on arrival. And so what we have is a restructuring, a neoliberal, corporate power, free trade, white power kind of program that is being hailed as Detroit's savior. The idea that it's going to benefit Detroit as the people of Detroit is just a sick joke.
Meanwhile, people on pensions are looking forward anxiously to how much they're going to lose under this new and restructured Detroit.
Right. This is the issue of the moment for people who are surviving just barely on publicly funded, state constitutionally guaranteed pensions that are proposed to be cut here. And, you know, the good news is that in the course of the bankruptcy, between the uprising of the people, the unions, the oversight of the federal bankruptcy judge, and just the entire real-world consequences of the legal and political and economic schemes that were hatched by Jones Day and the other Governor Snyder and Alec and these other overseers, between the pushback, in other words, there have been significant reductions to the cuts that the pensioners are now being asked to accept, to vote yes on. You know, the question is, for each individual pensioner, which does not include me, I don't receive a pension, for each individual pensioner, how much are these cuts for them and their personal financial situation going to affect their life? You know, if it's, are we talking about one or two less vacations in the course of the rest of your life and maybe less extensive vacations type things? Or are we talking about, oh my God, where am I going to live and how am I going to afford my medicine? And I think it's decisions like that, you know, in some cases real gut-wrenching decisions, and we don't have time to go into all the complexities of it because it involves a city clawback of money that was paid under annuities that people invested in. It involves cutting cost of living increases. It involves a 4.5% reduction across the board in the pension for the civilian employees, but not for the police and fire. And it involves, of course, the big cut, which they already imposed, eliminating healthcare for these folks. So, you know, it's some of it depends on whether you're already 65 or whatever, and you're 67 or whatever, and you qualify for Social Security and Medicaid.
And with all of that, even if the pensioners vote no, the federal judge is not obligated to pay their vote any attention, is he?
Absolutely right. You're looking at, you know, the federal judge, the bankruptcy judge is so invested in this, and his demeanor has been princely. You know, he's been very, very hardworking and on top of all these issues, but, you know, in the end, he's got a job to do, and he's doing it, and nobody knows what is really going to happen here. The open secret, if you are actually in court and pay attention, is that they are making this up as they go along. No federal court has ever adjudicated Chapter 9 bankruptcy in a city like Detroit, with Detroit's size, with its debt, with its social issues, with its economic issues, its governance issues, and all the issues that face a city here in 2014 and going forward, the whole crisis of ecology and energy and the economy, which is, oh my God, where are we going to get jobs, you know? Guess what? We're not building cars like we did when we built Detroit, and nobody plans to build cars in Detroit like they did. Couldn't sell them, couldn't use them anyway. So there's this unanswered question about what a community like this does to move forward as the spokespeople for capital talk endlessly about emerging from bankruptcy. And you say, well, what does that mean? Well, it means theft, systematic fraud, and making the rich richer and the poor poorer, and saying that it's, you know, doing the city well. And that's where, you know, Jamie Dimon comes in with his $100 billion publicity photo op.
Meanwhile, the elected officials of Detroit look on as spectators.
Yeah, some of them as opportunists, some of them as activists, some of them as demoralized spectators, some of them as, you know, more or less trying to figure out what to do spectators, a whole range of things. You wouldn't believe how much opportunism comes out of the woodwork in a situation like this. It's really been an education for everybody.
What opportunities are there for the opportunists among the politicians? They don't have an effective say in this.
Well, Mayor Duggan, the newly elected Mayor Duggan, arrived as mayor of a city where the mayor's budget for the last 3 years has been about $2 million. He signed an agreement with the emergency manager who represents the governor. Of course, he used to work for Jones Day. And he wasn't going to rock the boat. And basically, he's the city manager for them. And his budget this year is now $7 million. So that was a pretty good bonus. The council members who were elected, also pretty much a Chamber of Commerce-funded slate, are all pretty much singing from the same hymnal, too. You know, you have a crushing political pressure here. You know, if you stand up and say, no, this is not right, you know, you have to do something for the human rights of the masses in this city. They say, okay, well, thank you very much. Good luck with that. You know, next. And if you say, well, you know, I don't like emergency management, or as Duggan always says, whether I like it or not, it's here to stay, so I have to deal with it. You can be rewarded if you deal with it the right way, and that's what's happening.
And your politicians will be judged by their behavior during this period of bankruptcy.
Yeah, I think they've already been judged by most people, don't you, Glenn? I mean, you know, the fact is that, and they even realize this, you know, that most people look at them as useless. And that's because they are useless. And, you know, what they do is they blame it on their predecessors, because we've had some predecessors here, you know, some in prison, some have been to prison and come out, and they're easy to blame it on. But, you know, the underlying reality is that all of these people, the disgraced former imprisoned leaders, the current leaders, the ones that looked down impotently, lost, went on and refused to look at the alternatives and offer the kind of leadership and vision that the times call for, all of them have been undergirded by groups like the Regional Chamber of Commerce, right? Like the corporate free trade, Democratic, Republican, corporate state powers that be in this new American new order that we have since the crash. And, you know, the people are just locked outside, right? And so we'll see how long they can make that last. They're playing a very dangerous game for themselves and for everybody else.
That was People's Lawyer Tom Stevens in Detroit.
Commencement ceremonies have come and gone at Temple University in Philadelphia, but student and community activists say they will continue to demand that Dr. Anthony Monteiro be reinstated to the African American Studies Department. The larger goal is an end to Temple's role in gentrification of surrounding black neighborhoods. African American Studies Chairman Dr. Molefi Asante has admitted complicity in Dr. Monteiro's firing. Kashara White is one of the leaders of the protest and a student of African American Studies.
We've got an email from the provost saying that his office did an internal investigation of the firing of Dr. Monteiro, or the non-renewal of his contract. And basically, he's saying, according to their investigation, they didn't do anything that was out of policy. So they, according to him, the decision to let go of Dr. Monteiro wasn't a decision made by just Dr. Asante, but it was a collective decision made by all the tenured professors in the Department of African American Studies. And that's what he wanted to investigate, whether or not it was an individual who fired Dr. Monteiro, or whether it was a collective decision because the department is allegedly moving in a different direction, and that is away from the teachings of Dr. Monteiro's work, which is primarily in Dr. Du Bois. That's what we've heard from the administration. The students, what we've been pushing thus far, isn't that the school isn't following their policy. What we believe is that their policy is unjust, and what we want to see is more just policies that allow adjunct professors more job security, as well as non-tenure track professors and grad students. We want to see more favorable policies towards their job security. And what we're getting from the administration is that students and community people, even though we put millions of dollars into the Temple University, we don't have a say in what goes on at the university. So we're fighting for students and community people to have a voice, a real voice, and real voting power at the university when it comes to these matters and similar matters, the matters on gentrification and where Temple is and is not allowed to buy property. They don't talk to us about that. We just have to sort of deal with it when they make these decisions, even if they're not in our favor.
So your position is, regarding Professor Monteiro, that even if they did do a headcount with the African American Studies Department faculty, and it's not clear that they did, that the students that weren't involved in that decision, and that's your grievance.
Yes, the students were not involved in any decision concerning changing the curricula, nor were we involved in the decision to let go of Dr. Monteiro or Dr. Max Stanford. And what we want is real voting power in the departments. So we want students to have a voice in these matters. And what we're going to do is we're going to continue action throughout the summer and in the fall semesters to be able to get this voting power. And we're not going to stop. We believe that Dr. Monteiro has a rightful place in the Department of African American Studies, and we also believe that Du Boisian Studies is central to African American Studies as a student body. We don't want to let that go, so we're going to continue action. We're going to do outreach, especially in Norris Holmes, where Temple, in the beginning of the struggle, they had assured us as a student coalition that they were working with people in Norris Holmes to try to make the relationship between Temple University and Norris Holmes, which is a housing project that's right on the outskirts of Temple, like it's literally right there. We decided that we were going to let the people in Norris Holmes know about Temple's gentrification plan. And the plan is, ironically, is called the People's Plan. And what they plan to do is give all of the people in Norris Holmes housing vouchers to be able to live somewhere else for a year, rebuild Norris Holmes, equipped with tennis courts and all other manner of gentrified spaces, acting as if they're planning to move these people back into Norris Holmes. But what they're really doing is they're going to hike up the rent prices so high that the people won't be able to live there anymore. So we want to inform those people of that, and that Temple University will be getting a grant from the state to facilitate this gentrification process and ultimately have students and other Temple-affiliated people, like faculty and other people who work there, to move into that space. And so we want to continue action against gentrification. We're going to be documenting things. We have film students who are working on some pieces that we want to release to the public, and just to let everybody know what's going on at Temple isn't unique, but it's a part of a larger neoliberal project to push working class people, particularly Black and Latino people, further into the margins while white people can further enjoy city life. And North Philadelphia is not even the only place in Philadelphia where this is happening. It's happened in West Philadelphia already with Drexel and Penn. I even know that they've tried several times to buy a really large housing project to turn into dormitories. It's called West Philadelphia Park Projects. They've tried to buy those projects and the city won't let them. For years they've been trying to do this. So it's a long process, but the student coalition that we've built is strong. We've been planning and preparing ourselves for a long struggle against this gentrification, but more importantly, or more immediately, to reinstate Dr. Monteiro, because without him at the university advocating for these people in North Holmes, advocating for student power and adjunct and non-tenure professorship, there really isn't that much support within the university. The students are organizing, but the faculty is too afraid, because the provost admitted to me and my comrades who are in the meeting with me that they're attempting to hire the least amount of tenure track professors in every department, and that's something that Temple is kind of proud of. They want to do that. But with that means that more and more professors don't have job security enough to speak out on these issues. So, yeah, I'm a non-tenure track professor or adjunct professor. I can speak out. I can stand up with the students, but then I cannot be here next year. And so that's what the faculty is risking, because the majority of them are adjuncts and are not tenured. and the university wants to keep it that way. So what students are also attempting to do is to organize faculty, because without the support of the faculty and support within the university, then a lot of our voices, because we don't have voting power, because we don't have a real say on campus, a lot of our voices go mute. And what happens is we just seem as if we're agitators of some kind of cause.
Yes, Dr. Molefi Asante's the chairman of African American Studies, who was part of the firing of Dr. Monteiro, says he wants to change the name of the department to the Department of Africology and to purge it of what we call the Black radical tradition.
Yes, Dr. Molefi Asante, his recent outbursts on social media have been very disappointing for me as an African-American studies student, and for so many other students who have been a part of this movement. I think that it is my opinion that Africology is just a new branding mechanism for him to brand his Afrocentricity rhetoric and wrap it in a little bow so that he can sell it more appropriately. That's the way I feel as an individual. But as a coalition, we've responded to his attacks on Dr. Monteiro and the coalition. We've responded on Facebook as well as in other publications. But I think that what really needs to happen for us to move forward as a community is to get rid of Dr. Asante and his antics, because at this point, it's a blatant attack on Black people. And he can talk about Dr. Montero's voice being anti-African, but I can't see Dr. Asante having this much support for anything he does in Philadelphia as Dr. Montero has had for his reinstatement. And the reason why I say that is because I'm from North Philadelphia. I am in the community, but I'm also a student at Temple University, and I've never heard of Dr. Asante before I got to Temple University in Philadelphia. I'm from Philadelphia. I've heard of Dr. Montero. I've seen him at events and things like that. And I know people who know him, and I don't know anybody who's ever cared or known about Dr. Asante or his works. And I think that this whole shift to Africology as opposed to African American studies is an attempt to privilege continent-born Africans and their worldview or their ideology and their culture over African Americans and Afro-Caribbeans and Afro-Latino people. And I think that it's just a new branding mechanism for the entire Afrocentricity brand that he's created and that he's so proud of. And it's unfortunate that the African American Studies Department has to suffer because of an individual and his own economic endeavors, because that's what it is. It's him trying to make money.
And the role that Dr. Asante has played has made your job as student activists much more complicated, not just because of his particular ideology, but because it diverts attention away from what the university administration, mostly white, is doing.
Absolutely. I think that it is a type of diversion, because it's very easy to have this black-on-black sort of argument. Why are these brothers arguing over this space or whatever? But what's really happening, what we're really facing, is this issue over labor at the university. Who is and who isn't allowed to have job security? Who is and who isn't allowed to work at the university? What should we pay these people? Adjunct professors at Temple University get paid something around $3,000 a class. That's what we're worried about. We're not really worried about Dr. Asante and his antics. What we really want to attack is a white supremacist, racist policy and culture, an anti-working class culture that Temple has been breeding for the last about 10 years. We really want to fight against gentrification. We really want to fight against all of these ills that the university has placed in this space. Without the university, all of these things that are happening to the North Philadelphia community would not be happening. And these things are facilitated by the university and encouraged by the university, by their policies, by their administrators, and by the culture that the university creates, where these white students come from the suburbs and treat North Philadelphia as their stomping grounds or as their trash can, and they stay here for 4 years, and they move on with their lives, leaving all of their trash in the gutters of North Philadelphia. And that's what we're really fighting against. Dr. Asante, his antics, anything he really says at this point has been a distraction from the real struggle about labor and about gentrification that this coalition really got together to fight. We didn't have any interest early on, especially as a student coalition, to attack Dr. Asante. And the reason is because we saw it as a distraction, even though we recognized his role as a traitor in the situation. Students have been organizing since January to reinstate Dr. Montero. But what this has become is a lot larger and a lot more epic than what we originally got together to do. And yes, we want Dr. Montero reinstated, and yes, we want better working conditions for all faculty at the school. But what has happened is something against Temple's interest, and that is students are organizing for student power on campus, and we will continue to organize until we achieve our goals, and we will continue to strive and fight. We'll continue to be in these civil disobedience squabbles. We'll continue to do this as long as Temple is not hearing our voices, and I think that this is the worst thing for Temple University, but it's the best thing for us because we have people's power. And I believe that everything we do from this point forward is going to set a precedent for other students to be encouraged to organize and rise up against injustices, especially since we pay so much money to be here. I know people are $80,000, $100,000 in debt and loans because they wanted to graduate from a university. And it doesn't make any sense to me or anybody else in the coalition that I should be in debt more than I could ever afford to pay back in order to get these credentials. And these people who are millionaires sit in these offices and they make these decisions that change my life, my degree, whether or not I can get a job after I graduate. They make decisions that are based off of things like that and then tell me that I have no voice in those decision-making processes. This is going to set a standard for students in Philadelphia, but students really across the nation, because we deserve to be a part of those decision-making processes. And we want Dr. Montero back because we know that he sets that same precedent for faculty to stand up against administrations who are unjust, racist, and retaliatory, as this administration has been towards him and all of us in the struggle.
And this administration is hoping that over the summer, all this will dissipate.
Absolutely, and it will not. Since commencement started, we've been in 4 different meetings deciding our next steps. And we'll continue to meet over the next 2 weeks, and then we will have some sort of direct action within the next few weeks. But we're doing that as a student coalition, and the larger community and labor and faith-based coalition that has been behind Dr. Montero, we have their complete support in that.
That was Kashara White, a student leader at Temple University. Dr. Malefi Asante, the African American Studies chairman, who owes his job largely to student and community protests last year, has blasted the student activists as white communists. Glenn Ford has this commentary.
What began last year as a student and community battle to save African American studies from a racist dean of liberal arts at Temple University in Philadelphia is now compelled to also confront the bizarre and ugly specter of McCarthyism in blackface. Malefi Asante, who became chairman of the African American Studies Department thanks to the student and community campaign, almost immediately betrayed them by collaborating in the firing of Dr. Anthony Montero, a leader of the protests, native Philadelphian and W.E.B. Du Bois scholar who has taught African American studies at Temple for a decade. Asante initially claimed he had nothing to do with Temple's refusal to renew Monteiro's contract. But after university officials pointed at him as the instigator of the firing, Asante admitted that he wanted Dr. Monteiro out so that he could remake the department to more closely reflect his own narrow cultural nationalist politics. In other words, it was a political dismissal. Then, on May 8th, Dr. Cornel West and Dr. Mark Lamont Hill joined a rally in North Philadelphia demanding Dr. Monteiro's reinstatement and denouncing attempts to purge the radical black tradition from black studies. Asante went on a witch hunt, calling Cornel West and Mark Lamont Hill dupes and describing Dr. Monteiro's student supporters, who comprise a racial and political rainbow, as white communists. Asante claimed the North Philadelphia community had not attended the rally, when in fact a prominent community leader had organized it. Asante slandered Dr. Monteiro as a charlatan and low-level purveyor of Marxism and anti-African ideas. Asante has succeeded only in making himself a liability to Temple University. The scholars who drafted a letter demanding Monteiro's reinstatement with tenure, which was signed by 250 prominent educators, have issued a new statement. They deplored Dr. Asante's brazen demonization of student protesters and his deployment of racially divisive attacks, saying this, together with previous well-publicized charges of plagiarism and abuse of authority, make him unfit to make decisions about faculty or to lead an academic department. The students that Asante verbally abused also say he must be held accountable. They rejected Asante's ludicrous and ahistorical claim that socialism is somehow anti-black or anti-African, pointing out that W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King Jr., and Nelson Mandela were socialists, as was Kwame Nkrumah, the giant of modern Pan-Africanism. The students, who gathered 2,000 signatures of support from their peers at Temple, said Asante had firmly attached himself to the right-wing politics of Joseph McCarthy and J. Edgar Hoover. Having been thoroughly discredited for his betrayal of Dr. Monteiro and North Philadelphia, the students wrote, fear is the only card Dr. Asante has left to play. That, and his claim to be super black, the ultimate African, when, in the real world, he and others like him are ready to betray the struggle at the first opportunity, as they have repeatedly here and on the continent. Time after time, those who struggle for transformational change find that they must first fight their way through layers of Asantes before they can do righteous battle with the people who actually hold power. In this case, ironically, it is likely that the people in power will decide that Molefe Asante and his madness are too big a burden for Temple University to bear. They, too, will decide that Asante must go.
New Yorkers and African liberationists worldwide are mourning the death of legendary activist Ilambe Brath, who died on May 19th after a long illness. Brath was a founder of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition. He was honored on May 11th of last year at a tribute to Harlem's New Yorkers and African liberationists worldwide are mourning you distracted me. I'm sorry. You want me to start over?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. New Yorkers and African liberationists worldwide are mourning the death of legendary activist Ilambe Brath, who died on May 19th after a long illness. Brath was a founder of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition. He was honored on May 11th of last year at a tribute at Harlem's Harriet Tubman School. Brath was a key supporter of the Central Park Five, who were imprisoned for a rape they did not commit. One of the five, Raymond Santana, paid his respects.
You know, I didn't know Ilambe Brath for the many accomplishments and achievements that he acquired throughout his travels. I did know that he was also referred to as the walking encyclopedia. The Alam Bey that I met and know is a protector, a man who embraced me as one of his own sons, a man who stepped up for the Central Park Five when lots of people wouldn't. And to this day, he still champions for us to receive our just due. Alam Bey Brav is a perfect example of honor, of commitment, of strength. Because of Alam Bey's persistence in the pursuit of fighting injustice, we were able to meet our attorneys, Michael Warren and Roger Wareham, and also Evelyn Warren, who were the ones who got our convictions vacated, who were the ones, along with Alam Bey and many others, who helped set the motions that led to us getting our voices back, our dignity, and our humanity. It is because of Alam Bey Brav that Antron, Yusuf, Corey, Roger, Kevin, and myself will always be in debt to him for being the fighter that he is, for always taking the stand, looking injustice in the face, and for never being afraid, never backing down. To Alam Bey, Nomsa, the Brav family, we love you. Alam Bey!
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 Miss you. You will never be forgotten. Thank you.
That was Raymond Santana of the Central Park Five. Rodolfo Reyes, the Cuban ambassador to the United Nations, also paid homage to Alam Bey Brav back on May 11th, 2013.
Alam's work has gone beyond Harlem's borders. He joined the United Nations to raise the efforts for the rights of the African peoples and the international level. Alam Bey, along with many activists, namely our beloved Lucius Walker, to whom he was bound by sincere friendship, raised his voice to spread the truth on Cuba in the United States. Cuba remembers with high esteem his tireless struggle for the freedom of the Cuban Five heroes, unjustly imprisoned in the United States jails. By following the example of Alam Bey Brav, we can turn into reality the goal of our leader Fidel Castro, that a better world is possible, and attain a world where justice, human dignity, and solidarity prevail. Should this message convey the love, admiration, and respect of the Cuban people and government to that great man named Alam Bey Brav? Our heart and the whole Cuban people is with you. Thank you very much.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Martin Nwaga.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.